Good morning. Welcome to the Sunday, September 13th, 2015 edition of Waking Up, Freeing Ourselves from Work. Apologize for the late start. The wrong mic was set up and took a minute to find a one that worked that was rather connected. Brothers and sisters, before I forget, there's a question that I've been meaning to ask about drones. Often I've noticed when my connection is blocked, a drone hovering in the vicinity overhead. Whether I'm at home or at the library or outside one of the places I upload. So what I want to know is a hovering capability in a drone an expensive accessory? You see where I'm going? Is it only military? Anybody knows, please share. I'm very curious about that. Sisters and brothers, we are approaching our free future. Tell a cellmate, tell a loved one, a friend. After an unimaginable bludgeoning of us and the planet, 10,000 years of class is coming to an end. Marcuse referred to this time that we're in as the reversal, a good way, in many ways, to think of it. And the way we're considering today is from the aspect of the word itself, class. As Hirschman told us in our last show, it's a term that came suddenly upon us, which came not to be questioned. Quote, as happens frequently with concepts that are suddenly thrust to the center of the stage, class, elite, economic development. To name some more recent examples, interest appeared so self-evident a notion that nobody bothered to define it precisely. Unquote. But though we are reversing from being classed, which necessarily means a hierarchical ordering, some group of folks imposing that idea on us, I think it makes more sense to see this as returning to our original wholeness at birth rather than to an earlier social arrangement, i.e., we are inventing something altogether new. As never before have we been consciously a global community of communities of fully developing individualities. Marx's observations and thought provide much insight into this question. Recall, for instance, the following comment of his from the August 13th show. Camille Desmoulins, Danton, Robespierre, Saint-Just, Napoleon, the heroes as well as the parties and the masses of the old French Revolution performed the task of their time in Roman costume and with Roman phrases, the task of unchaining and setting up modern bourgeois society. The first ones knocked the feudal basis to pieces and mowed off the feudal heads which had grown on it. The other, Napoleon, created inside France the conditions under which alone free competition could be developed, parceled landed property exploited, and the unchained industrial productive power of the nation employed. And beyond the French borders, he everywhere swept the feudal institutions away, so far as was necessary to furnish bourgeois society in France with a suitable up-to-date environment on the European continent. And my comment, recall that he's talking about a moment when the full horrors of the Industrial Revolution, so-called, were engulfing the English people. This is what he means by up to date. Continuing, the new social formation once established, the antediluvian Colossi disappeared, bourgeois society in its sober reality had begotten its true interpreters and mouthpieces in the Says, Cousins, Royer, Collards, Benjamin Constants, and Guizots. Its real military leaders sat behind the office desks, and the hog-headed Louis XVIII was its political chief. Unquote from the book we are going to get to, hopefully today, The 18th Brumaire. So, new bosses is what he's saying. New terms by which we may be eaten. And considering this in juxtaposition with the following linguistic observations, I'm encouraging us to think in terms of the evolution of statecraft, recalling that class was an idea imposed on us. Recalling that the thought that gets preserved and handed down generally is the thought that assists power with that state preservation project, i.e. the thought of the would-be social managers who would see in Plato a mission calling out for their gifts, and in the French Revolution, a spur to action. Class was imposed. By who and how? We are asking today. For guidance, I turn to Raymond Williams, who taught drama at Cambridge. Quote, class is an obviously difficult word, both in its range of meanings and in its complexity in that particular meaning where it describes a social division. The Latin word classis, a division according to property of the people of Rome, came into English in the late 16th century in its Latin form, with a plural classis or classes. But classis was primarily used in explicit reference to Roman history and was then extended first as a term in church organization. And my interjection, John Boswell's important book, The Kindness of Strangers, The Abandonment of Children in Western Europe from Late Antiquity to the Renaissance, sheds light on the innovators of Europe's intellectual life. He cites the monastery as the general destination for the abandoned children of the elite. This practice was known as oblation. An oblate is a thing presented or offered to God or a god. Quote from John Boswell's The Kindness of Strangers, The Abandonment of Children in Western Europe from Late Antiquity to the Renaissance. Quote, as a formal system, oblation bore striking resemblances to other forms of abandonment in terms of its social utility. For example, in limiting the number of heirs, a point emphasized by Plato in the Republic, the conflicts it raised about irrevocability, much like imperial Roman struggles over the permanence of servile status, and even some very technical details, the setting of 10, for example, as the ultimate age for such donations in some locales, matches age distinctions for other forms of parental divestment, such as fostering or sale. Dynastic considerations might render children not only unwanted, but dangerous. Younger sons or siblings regularly challenged succession to the thrones of early medieval Europe, and children of second and third marriages represented threats to those of the first and vice versa. The motif of the child destined to injure his parents, his family, or his kingdom, ubiquitous in ancient and medieval mythology and folklore, must to some extent reflect anxieties of this sort. The fewer full-grown male relatives a king had around him, the easier he slept at night. Abandoning such persons as children through exposing, that's just sort of setting them on the road, hanging them in a tree, through exposing fosterage or oblation was certainly more humane than murdering them, sometimes resorted to in later ages. The daily life of oblates was not greatly different from that of children in strict religious boarding schools in many ages, except that in addition to school and work, they had long and exacting liturgical duties throughout the day. By and large, the monastic daily regimen involved about 4 hours of liturgy, 4 of reading, 6 of work, 6 to 8 hours of sleep from about 5 p.m. to about 2 a.m., and 2 to 4 hours for eating, hygiene, and other physical needs. Most oblates would have spent more time in school than at work. Children were required to eat standing, but were usually given more meat and fed more frequently than the adult monks, although the amounts and variety were still ascetic. In influential Carolingian commentaries, a special diet is prescribed for each year of childhood, and that's unquote from The Kindness of Strangers, The Abandonment of Children in Western Europe, from Late Antiquity through the Renaissance. And there's a lot in that quote that's suggestive in light of the excerpts we've been reading from Alice Miller's For Your Own Good, when we commented on the clear antagonism, I guess you could say, yeah, antagonism of some parents toward the children and this need to perceive the child as the enemy was quite striking. And there may be some underlying historical anxiety, as he said, being expressed.